baby boomers.
I used to be with it.
Millennials.
Okay, boomer.
Generation X.
What's going now?
And Gen Z. What do they have in common? Not a lot, it turns out. But one thing they can agree on is that this is the political podcast they want to listen to. Welcome to Not My Generation, the political podcast that looks at political events, news, and happenings across the world and at home through a generational lens. Your hosts are Dr. Emily Stacey and Professor James Davenport, two political scientists from Rose State College. But the views expressed on this program are solely the views of the host and their guests and do not reflect the views of Rose State College, its administration, faculty, or students. Coming up on today's program.
I want to inspire people personally to pay attention. And that means I got to hold myself accountable for the words I use.
Oh, honey, your problem is you still think you're middle-aged.
I looked a lot younger before I got elected. I don't want to do that. I don't want to inject the partisanship into civics education.
Definitely my favorite Republican.
And now, here are James and Emily.
Good morning, Emily.
Good morning, James. How are you?
Good. Was that a pretty moderated intro?
Very well done. Not too exuberant.
For a Friday morning. I'm trying to find the happy
balance.
Medium.
Yes, yeah. Right.
We are here in the fantastic podcast studios of Possibilities, Inc.
Indeed.
Along with our famous producer, Peaches, who is keeping us all sounding good and fantastic. How's your morning been so far?
Pretty good. Busy, but good, right? The child is out of school this morning. So we did a little cuddling and, slow playing it this morning. And so, yeah.
Those are good mornings.
Indeed.
They are good mornings. Well, I am feeling all of my middle-aged self for the last couple of weeks with my knee problems and such. And I was complaining about that to my wife this morning. And my wife says, oh, honey, your problem is you still think you're middle-aged. And so
That's tough, right?
I love my wife. She's wonderful.
Of course she does.
But she does keep my ego in check sometimes. So other than that, things are going good. I had to go into the office early this morning, which is also, you know me, I'm not an early morning
person. You are not a morning person. You're very grumpy.
Yes. But I was on my best behavior.
Good. I'm glad. Glad to hear it.
And even made it here on time. So,
very good. Yeah. We would be remiss before we get started and, into our substance today and not acknowledging the fact that today is the 29th anniversary of the April 19th Murrah Building bombing. I just wanted to draw attention to that. We mentioned it actually on the last episode. I think I did a little bit of flashing back whenever Tara mentioned her generational kind of the events that kind of shaped her. Obviously a day of remembrance, of reverence, et cetera. Max actually just put out on Tuesday a really great documentary that was executive produced by Katie Couric on April 19th. So if you get a chance, do check that out. It's a very interesting kind of unraveling of the kind of dogma and manifesto and the kind of ideology that McVeigh was kind of under the spell of that led to April 19th. So if you get a chance, please do take a look at that. And of course, remember, right? Never forget.
Absolutely. Still looms large in our state. We have a fantastic guest today.
We do. We love this guy, actually.
And he is State Senator Adam Pugh from Edmond, Oklahoma.
Indeed.
And we're going to be talking all sorts of things, but Senator Pugh was first elected in 2016, if I got
correctly.
Yep. He is now the chair of the Senate Education Committee.
Yes, and Appropriations, correct?
And Appropriations Subcommittee.
Yeah. All right. Yep. So, I know my stuff, man. I know what you, right?
All things education.
Yes.
This is the person you want to know, guy. Right?
Yeah. I must say he is probably, I shouldn't say probably one, definitely my favorite Republican. Currently serving.
Is that a low bar that I'm jumping over?
It is a very high bar, sir. We really do. I enjoy you. I like that you are very committed to education. Obviously, that's something extremely important to our hearts. K-12 and obviously higher education is what we do. And so we really appreciate dedication, obviously, on both sides of the aisle, but particularly right now in the state. From your side of the aisle, we appreciate the support.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
Well, we have some kind of get to know you questions that we're going to, we always start off with. So you have to endure these like all of our other guests. And then we'll get into more of the substantive questions that we have for you. Emily, why don't you lead us off?
Sure. Are you a Gen X, millennial, or other?
I'm Gen X.
You're not.
Yes.
No, you're not.
I'm a Gen Xer.
Right there. Yes.
When is your birthday?
I'm the end of Gen X. I'm 1990s. Jeepers. I'm 1977.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So I'm the end of Gen X. I looked a lot younger before I got elected.
My goodness. How's that? You look extraordinarily young.
I can imagine that.
Man, yes.
I'm so uncomfortable on a podcast. I told you in the beginning. I've never done a podcast before. So I see Peaches is laughing at me in the back.
I had an ally here.
All right. What are you currently reading, watching, or listening to?
Okay. Can I answer all three of those?
Sure, absolutely. Right.
So nobody ever does. Thank
so
you.
I'm late to the game. I'm actually reading Atomic Habits.
Okay.
Which is, I think I was hoping for something more life-changing for me. It's actually pretty straightforward, and we all know, right, all change is incremental and cumulative. You do these small things. Instead of looking at the big goal, you just try to do daily, win the day, you know, make these small changes, and they all add up. And that's fine. It's all things I know, but it's good to be, reminded, and it's packaged in certainly a more articulate way than probably I could, work through myself. And then, my music taste is quite varied.
Okay.
I'm not going to lie. Like, I love music.
Yes.
I've played the drums for almost 40 years now. And so I grew up listening to music with my mom.
Yeah.
So I actually have a much older soul. I love Chicago, Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yes, yep.
But I've got little kids and I try to stay cool and fresh. And so last night a new Taylor Swift album came out. So my daughter had sleepover and this was like a big deal. I guess it was going to be released in the middle of the night. And so of course I got to jam around the house with my kiddos. I teach a boot camp class at the YMCA, at 5:30 in the mornings.
Oh,
I teach boot camp up in Mitch Park.
I won't see you at 5:30. I'm just putting that out there right now.
It's not my preferred time to be working out, but I found the most stressful thing is not the workout. It's actually the playlist that you're going to have with your workout.
Okay.
And what I've noticed when I come in with a really good playlist in the morning, like the people who are there to take the class, they get a little more into
it, and we
get more out of the workout. And so that takes a lot of effort.
It does.
To build
curate
a good Spotify playlist.
It does.
For sure. So, and then my wife and I, we've got little kids and so life is busy. So we generally get one TV show episode a night.
Yeah.
And we just started this wild, I'm probably going to get in trouble for this show, I'm sure, but we just started this wild show called The Gentleman.
Oh, okay.
I've seen some advertisements for it. I haven't started it
it's
yet.
It's about a British Duke who's very long in the list of, royal lineage, but he inherits a marijuana farm.
Yeah, this is great.
From his dad when he passes away and he didn't realize it. And so he's wrapped up into this seedy underbelly of illegal drug operations while also being nobility. Yeah. So
it's a little
trippy.
Yeah. I love it.
Is it Ewan McGregor? Is he, who's the star of that?
It's a guy from, a previous show called, I can't think of the name. He was in a series, a movie series where they made three shows. I'll think of it.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I'm much better with music than I am with Hollywood people.
I gotcha.
So it'll come to me.
He's very familiar.
He's a charming guy with a British accent.
Yes.
And
all right, and that's what we know.
That's what we know.
Exactly.
All right.
Favorite social media platform.
Is none of the above an answer? This is my Gen X coming out, by the way. As the more you get to know me, Dr. Stacey, you're going to realize, he actually is a get off my lawn kids grumpy old man. So
you are so cute.
I know I have a Facebook account because I feel forced to.
Right.
And I feel like that's the Kodak of, sure. you know, of social media accounts at this point.
Very
and
much so, yes. Yeah. You're MySpacing it to anybody older than 30.
Oh, I was definitely.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Or AOL Instant Messenger if you really want to go back in time.
Oh, honey. Me too. It's okay. I'm old too. I'm getting there.
What is your favorite pastime or hobby?
I love all things sports, for sure. I do like working out. It's, you know, obviously the health implications, but it also at this point has become a little bit of a stress relief for me to just be able to go to the gym and be like, okay, I'm just going to like throw some weights around.
My day is always better when I have been in the gym. Yes. I'm just going to say,
I mean, it like mentally, you know, kind of, but I like to eat. Like I am a purveyor and connoisseur of food, all foods. Yeah. Good and bad, really.
Right. So, I'll try it once.
Yes. So
it's great. What are your teams? Your sports teams?
Okay, so
now I'm going to get you in trouble. Here we go.
So you know, I'm a Yankee transplant, right? Oh, now okay. I've been here for 20 something years, and this is certainly home. But you know, there's some deep roots there when it comes to my rooting interests. So I'm a New York Mets fan, and it's baseball season. I rebelled against all things Philadelphia. You know, let's just say that everybody in my area was a Phillies and Eagles and Sixers and Flyers. So I'm a Mets fan, a New York Giants fan, a New York Rangers fan. Now, as a child of the 80s, I mean, I was a Chicago Bulls Michael Jordan fan.
Okay.
I moved when I moved here. You know, we didn't have an NBA team at the time, and then I think like probably almost every Oklahoman just fell in love with the Thunder, and certainly I'm a Thunder fan. I got my MBA at OU. And so you kind of get grafted into the vine, I guess.
Yes, exactly,
you
know, right.
And become an OU
born
fan.
And bred, yes.
But what's funny is in Edmond, I would say probably 3/4 of my constituents have a more connection to OSU and Stillwater.
I
don't know if it's just, you know, proximity, you know, to Stillwater versus being closer on the south side of the state and closer to Norman. Mm-hmm. And so I noticed that when I was knocking doors.
I bet.
You know, which
you
was,
to eat
which
it a
was
bit?
Interesting. Oh, yeah. I'm, you know, I can be a good politician and root for everybody. I don't look great in orange, I'm sure. But certainly, you know, when they're not playing each other, probably, again, like a lot of Oklahomans. And without that, you know, kind of genetic disposition to root for one or the other, I am happy for both teams to be successful.
But the bottom line is Boomer Sooner. It's okay. I said it. He didn't. All right. Finally, one event. What is one event, I should say, that occurred in your lifetime that has had the most impact on your politics or political beliefs?
Oh, that's a great question. So I'm going to go a little deeper on this maybe and not be so superficial. So growing up in the 80s, there was a show, right, called Family Ties.
Yes. Yes.
With Michael J. Fox playing the role of Alex P. Keaton, right?
And it was look a little bit alike,
and it was
actually.
Well, I appreciate that. And it was a really funny show because if you remember, the very first season of that show was actually about the parents, right? It was about these kind of hippie parents out of the 70s who were raising kids and struggling with, you know, midlife and kind of the challenges of raising a family. The second year of the show, it flips and it becomes much more about Alex B. Keaton, right? As this kind of funny little nerdy Republican kid who's in a very liberal 70s kind of family. And I don't know what it was about that show I gravitated towards. You know, he'd wear his little Republican power tie and he had a big poster of Ronald Reagan in his bedroom. And somehow I identified with that kid.
That tracks, I think. I feel that a lot.
And so I did. I actually fell in love with Ronald Reagan because of that. And really, you know, I think for Republicans and Democrats, you know, Ronald Reagan, I think, was just this very larger than life, you know, political figure. And, you know, the idea of uniting around just defeating communism was a very bipartisan message, right? The world is better when America is strong, right? The world is better when we're helping other peoples be free. The world is better when we're tearing down walls, whether literally or figuratively, right, that are dividing, you know, cultures and populations and creating unnecessary strife. and let's grow the economy. And so really, you know, just he is a political figure, like a lot of probably Republicans of that era. I was just attracted to kind of that really big personality. And I think just growing up in a small town where to this day, I'm convinced that I was the only Republican family in my small town. Yeah. And it kind of gave me something to rally around and try to learn, you know, why? Like, I know my mom's a Republican, but why is that attractive to me as a kind of a political, you know, ideology? And I had to kind of, you know, think through that because I did have the opportunity to defend that a lot of times in my little town. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of, you know, I tell that story because sometimes I think we're not good at articulating why we believe what we believe or what informed our value sets. And so I've really wanted to be able to articulate that to young people. And it isn't in a process of, you know, conversion, you know, not proselytizing to them per se, but just being able to say, you know, what's informed, you know, my life and, you know, why have I chosen to kind of, you know, aspire to, you know, kind of accomplish certain things that can be seen through a political lens. So I try to, you know, maybe rise above that as much as I can. But certainly politically, there were some things that influenced me.
Yeah. I love that answer.
I'm going to offer a commentary. You do not have to respond to this. But as a former Republican, I think the Republican Party and the country at large would be much better served if Republicans started remembering the politics of Ronald Reagan more and the politics of Donald Trump less. Yeah. So I'm just going to put that out there. And I appreciate you because I watched Alex P. Keaton as well. and remember the poster of Reagan, just like you mentioned. So I'm right there with you as far as that time period and just how you know, coming out of the 70s were just miserable. They really were. And just kind of for a variety of reasons, that Reagan was able to tap into, but his optimism about America's future. And I think we need more of that today from both all sides, right? More of that optimism about, hey, things can be better and we can make them better if we'll work together to do so. I think we'd all benefit from that.
Are you or your organization looking for unvarnished, unbiased, scholarly political analysis for your op-eds, candidates' debates, or interviews regarding all things political?
Well, look no further. We are the Democracy Slingers. We're here to host, comment, educate, or just preach the good word of American politics to your school, club, company, or organization. Get in touch with us at democracyslingers@gmail.com.
And I tell people all the time, I'm an optimist by trade. It's really easy to walk into that building on 23rd and Lincoln and have the life sucked out of you. But I told my wife when I first got elected, I said, if I start coming home bitter and jaded, you know, tell me it's time to walk away from politics, because it is easy to become a pessimist, right? And you kind of divide people into little factions and voting blocks and pit people against each other. And it becomes zero sum and it becomes a blame game. And I think no matter what side of the political aisle you're on, my concern is look at what we're doing to young people, right? We're turning them away from civic engagement. Mm-hmm. We're turning them away from kind of the importance of paying attention to what policymakers do, elected or otherwise, right? And you look specifically in Oklahoma, you look at the 18 to 25, you know, voting demographic, it's a very low, you know, turnout, it's low voter engagement there. And in the long run, that's bad, right? That's bad for us. And so I try to be very mindful of that. And I want to be careful. And I'm comfortable walking into a group of folks who, you know, completely disagree with me or come from very different political, you know, perspectives, and defending who I am and what I stand for, and, you know, doing my best to articulate my policy position. And sometimes you win someone over, and most of the time you shake hands and walk away, and that's okay. And so I think that's it's important for us, though, to be able to engage in that public sphere in a manner that, you know, we can be empathetic towards each other.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, let's start with a general question about the legislative session and how your impressions. How do you feel like it has went so far? If you kept a scorecard, what would that look like at this point?
I'm gonna be as candid as I can here. Every session is different. You know, everybody says that, and it's funny. You don't know when you walk into session, what's the fight going to be this year, right? What's the policy, or is there going to be some big personality? And we're all, you know, you bring 149 people elected from different parts of the state into that building, and you know, there's always going to be the human, you know, aspect of this, and sometimes those interpersonal relationships are going to drive a lot of the things that are happening in that building. This year, I think, apart from kind of very specific policy things, the biggest thing is on the Senate side, and I can speak from my perspective as a senator. Our budget process has been significantly transformed this year under Greg Treat as the pro tem, and this has really been his. Kind of, he wants this to be his legacy, that he has in a positive way transformed the budget process to be more transparent, more out in the open and public, giving more time for public feedback and commentary. And so that has caused, truthfully, some tension on the other side of the building. Now, we have zero ability to change the House's budget process. Right. And I want to be very clear, I respect that, right? They have their own caucus rules, they have their own leadership, they value different things than we do, and we cannot influence, you know, to a manner maybe that I would hope that we could change, you know, the process in totality. We really don't have that authority. So we have changed our process significantly. And that's, you know, it's allowed us to produce a budget much earlier, to show the public the budget much earlier. And it's made us vulnerable to some degree because we've had to say, these are our priorities as a Senate, right? And that puts you in the hot seat.
It does.
And it causes some frustration on the other side of the building because maybe they're being pulled into this public conversation when there's some preference to keep this stuff behind closed doors as long as possible. And so that's really been, to this point, more than any particular piece of legislation, the biggest challenge between the House and the Senate.
It's interesting. So as we were walking down the hallway, in fact, I made the comment that you guys are moving a lot quicker. What I obviously was a reporter for quite some time with Sean Ashley and Quorum Call. And man, I remember, you know, it would be forever, like mid-May, before we started having appropriations and budgets meetings that actually contained numbers, where we were putting bills, numbers and budgets. So I'm impressed. I am very impressed by the transparency of the process. And I think you're correct. I think, you know, having the conversation earlier puts a lot of onus on the other side to also be part of that conversation because the process involves them. I commend Treat and the Senate for attempting to kind of really reform a budget process that was wildly malfunctioning.
Well, and if you know Senator Treat's political genealogy, so to speak, coming from U.S. Senator Tom Coburn, who was all about this kind of transparency and openness, it is not surprising that this has been a priority of his that he really wanted to see come to fruition.
And we think it'll last, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, we cannot retreat. There will be a strong desire as things get tougher as we get towards the end of session when everything starts to just funnel into those last couple of weeks where you're really hammering out the budget to want to retreat back to your old ways right when things get tough. And so we are being very intentional to not do that. And so when you ask about scorecard, I think the Senate's winning. And Alex, for take apart the, you know, I think transparency and all this stuff is better, but in the end, this week the House produced a public website with their budget on it. Mm-hmm. That's a, now you could say, okay, That's a win for the Senate. Absolutely. But it's actually just a win for the process and for the people of Oklahoma. Absolutely. That would not have happened had we not kind of continued to put pressure on them to bring their numbers public, right? We would still be 3 or 4 weeks away, as you mentioned, from really producing public numbers. So now they have a website where they are publicizing their budget numbers. The numbers may not be real. That can be a different discussion. But we've at least got a website up with some numbers on there.
This is and the public's going to get a feel for how these negotiations transpire, right? And I realize that there are times when maybe being able to have honest conversations out of the public limelight is helpful. But when you're talking about a budget that's going to impact all of the citizens of Oklahoma, I think this process of providing these numbers up front, letting people see what we're discussing and how things can play out is really helpful.
Yeah, I agree. So you and I actually, Senator Pugh and I, had a conversation on Higher Education Day at the Capitol after you did push-ups with one of my students, a moment that will not be forgotten by that young lady. That was so great. A point of personal privilege. I think that's why I find you so, I vibe with you so well is because I find you so endearing. Like, you are a genuine human being. You are not an obvious career kind of politician. You see people and you want to speak to the things that they care about, even if it's challenging you to a set of push-up contest to challenge your National Guard status. So anyway, we had a great conversation about civic advocacy and civic education. And so I just want to kind of you to go into why you are so passionate about it and why civic education is so important to the democracy and what plans maybe you have involving civic engagement.
Let's go all the way back to 1992.
Okay, he's taking us back.
All right. I'm going to speak in the third person, so not to be weird.
We do that sometimes.
Adam Pugh is a freshman in high school, and I'm walking into high school for the very first time, and I have a civics teacher named Santina Lonergan, right? It's quite a name, right? And Mrs. Lonergan made me fall in love with civics. She would celebrate Chester A. Arthur Day. So we had Chester A. Arthur, a very nondescript, right? If you ask the average American who is Chester A. Arthur, they probably wouldn't know he's a president. They certainly probably wouldn't know much about his presidency, right? And so we would celebrate Chester A. Arthur Day, and she had been doing this for years. And so she made me fall in love with civics. I mean, I just did. And I can remember in November of 92, Bill Clinton gets elected, defeats George H.W. Bush, right? I walked into class that next day brokenhearted.
You poor thing.
Yes, that's right. Misery. I mean, I was brokenhearted. No kidding. Like, I it was somber. It was like, Adam, who killed your cat? Like, sort of look on my face, right? And I walked in and, you know, I'm 5 feet tall. My last name's Pugh. I grew up, you know, just single mom. I didn't have a dad. I lacked a lot of confidence. And I walk into my class and I declare, it's a sad day for America. and so she gave me the opportunity to shine and build my confidence. I think she recognized that I had an aptitude for, you know, poli-sci and civics and history and just made me fall in love with it. And even after high school, I would go back and I would visit her like every year. Every time I was back in my hometown, I'd visit Mrs. Lonergan. And when I was on the campaign trail for the first time, she was the third person I called when I was running for office. So I called my mom, I called my sister, I called Mrs. Lonergan. And told her and unfortunately she passed away of cancer before I got elected. So we never got to reconnect there. But I tell that story everywhere I go of how impactful she was, my ninth grade civics teacher. And I don't know what it was, but you know, she made civics come alive for us and we tackled tough issues. If you remember 1992, it was Rodney King trial.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we tackled that issue inside my civics class. And we actually did a mock trial inside my class where, you know, someone represented the cops, someone represented Rodney King, and we had a jury and we discussed like the issues of the day in a very civil way, right? As civil as ninth graders could, and tried to tackle this big kind of social issue, right? About policing and about people of color. And like, it was, you know, I'm realizing more what I learned looking back, obviously, than I did in the moment. But that was really just her way of kind of bringing this stuff to life was awesome. And, you know, it's funny, I tell that story to my wife, and my wife grew up hating history because she had bad history teachers who weren't interesting, didn't make this stuff meaningful. She loves it now, loves it. And loves asking me questions. And then she says, I talk too much and my details, I get too detailed. That's too detailed. I just need, you know, high level things. But it's just so important for us. You know, I came to learn when I was on the campaign trail, we say a lot, like, we want people showing up and voting. And that's true. But I want informed voters. Yes. I mean, that's what drives a healthy, you know, democracy, constitutional republic, is not just people voting. The engagement's important, but being informed when you do it is wildly important, right? And the great thing about being the chair of education is I now have an opportunity. A lot of doors opened that maybe wouldn't have naturally opened before, where I could walk into schools and get to talk to young people, not just in Edmond, which is obviously where my kids go. And probably, you know, I could probably go to most schools in Edmond anytime I wanted. But I've had the opportunity to do things like this, right? Where I get to kind of go around the state now and talk to young people, show up on college campuses and speak at things. I got to speak at the, you know, that JCPenney Leadership School down in OU. And you know, and I got to talk to the College Republicans and the Campus Democrats, right? And you know, they want to talk about higher ed issues, obviously, but it got the chance to kind of tell these stories of why it's so important to do civic engagement. Jason Dunnington, who's a very good friend of mine, who is a Democrat representative from downtown Oklahoma City, he and I, when he was still in office, we actually launched a little nonprofit called From Now On, and we got a bunch of high schoolers together. And to my knowledge, still, we hosted the first ever student-led gubernatorial debate between Drew Edmondson and Kevin Stitt. And it was down at OCCC. And we took a bunch of kids from across the state and did like a civic engagement program with them. And then they built their own questions and they were the host. And to their credit, both, you know, Drew and Governor Stitt showed up, you know, on the campaign trail. They didn't have to, obviously. And these students got to kind of see this in action. And I followed the majority of those students since and the kind of through their college. And a lot of them, you know, have stayed engaged. And I think part of that experience probably at least helped, you know, if it didn't light the fire, it maybe made it burn brighter.
Absolutely.
Okay. So what, if any, effort is out there to kind of institutionalize this kind of civic education in a way that it will stick and be meaningful?
Yeah. There are always a lot of, you know, education tends to have usually the most bills filed, assigned to my committee, as well as probably in the House Education Committee as well. And as you can imagine, those bills are all over the place, right? Whether it be dealing with curriculum or dealing with, you know, school boards or, you know, books or funding, you know, teacher pay, whatever it is. And so I've had a bill several years, and fortunately, I think it's just been so big and comprehensive, it's been hard for us to really wrap our arms around it and really transforming civics education in the state of Oklahoma. It's something I'll keep going back to the drawing board on because I think it's really important. So really, probably to date, we've nibbled at the edges, in my opinion, around really kind of comprehensive civics education reform. And what I don't want to do is politicize it, right? Which is, I think, kind of our tendency is we all go to our camps and we say, well, if we're going to do civics education, we got to use this curriculum, or we got to do this, or we got to make sure they learn my perspective. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to inject the partisanship into civics education. So I'm sad to report I haven't been as transformative in that area as I would like to be. So I have to do it, you know, really probably outside that building, mm-hmm. right? Just kind of through a grassroots effort of, you know, educating and kind of inspiring kids to pay attention and get involved. You know, this week we hosted Youth Leadership Edmond at the Capitol, which is juniors and seniors and all the different Edmond schools who participate in this year-long program. And one of their parts is coming to the Capitol and hearing from the Edmond delegation. And so trying to do more things like that. And then, you know, for me, it's just personal accountability. I want to inspire people personally to pay attention. And that means I got to hold myself accountable for the words I use, you know, to not turn people off and say, oh, look at those idiots. They can't get along. Look at the way they treat each other, how they talk to each other. Why would I ever pay attention to what those knuckleheads are doing? Just leave me alone, right? You have to, yeah. Right? So it's, for me at this point, it's much more personal than anything I've been able to accomplish legislatively.
Okay. So what ideas are being discussed to help ensure that the new school choice legislation will actually result in better educational outcomes for students?
So we focused, you know, the Senate and the House had vehement disagreements there. And what we focused on in the Senate was kind of prioritizing the lower socioeconomic. And if you remember 3 years ago, that was the only piece of school choice legislation. It failed on the Senate floor, unfortunately, where it was only for a certain income and below. The House wanted it wide open. But the Senate's response was, fine, we'll do it wide open, but let's prioritize, right? If we're really going to transform kids who maybe don't have access and opportunity, then we got to focus on that lower socioeconomic rung. There's still some cleanup language. You know, admittedly, it's been a clunky implementation. That was going to be, and I think that's been the case everywhere. So I think the pro tem ran a bill yesterday. You know, we want to make sure it's not a taxable event. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that if someone is carrying, you know, some sort of tax debt, that this tax credit doesn't first pay off a previous tax debt, because then it's counter to, you know, the educational opportunity. So I think we'll have to continue to work on this as the program matures.
We're button up against time. I was notified, but I want to throw this out there to you, because I have always been a very passionate advocate of school choice. But I accept that there are some ways that are better of doing things than others. I would really like to see either the State Department of Education or some other body become a data collection and distribution point that doesn't, I am not into this where we're going to rate schools. The variation is so different. Schools live in different environments. They have different student populations. This kind of one size fits all rating scale that we're going to give them an A or an A, I think that is fundamentally flawed. But what the state could do is gather data on all of these schools. And I think I'm not opposed to a requirement that says if you're a private school that's receiving this tax credit to pay for that, you must report this data to us, right? And then make that data public about the performance of those schools in these different ways. And that's going to require some emphasis on finding people who understand how to collect and report data and the kind of data that is actually going to give people information on how schools are performing. And I think what you're going to find is there are very few schools that perform highly in every possible area. That's just almost impossible to do. But you're going to have some schools that perform well here, some that perform well in this, some that perform well in here. And now if I'm a parent and I have a child that maybe I want them in a music program, well, this school has a great music program. And I know that because I can see this data and it shows the performance there. And I would like to see the state back away from, we're going to mandate all of this stuff, to saying, we're going to provide solid information so parents can actually make use of the choice they have and make that work for them. And so I'm just throwing that idea out there for you to consider. And maybe we can have some more conversation about that down the line. But I think if we want school choice to work, we got to give parents the right information to make solid decisions.
We have an agency that's been historically underutilized called OEQA, right? Mm-hmm. And they have a new director. I don't know if you've ever had the chance to interact with her yet. Her name's Megan Oftedal. She actually was a data scientist for Meta.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's a you know, very high level
so
data analytics.
We need to have a conversation. Yeah.
And we're trying to, you know, more utilize her office. And it's, you know, kind of a across the board, teacher pipeline data, right? Teacher supply and demand, teacher prep programs and how they're performing, getting down into high levels of fidelity. Because I agree with you on the A through F report card. I don't like it as is. We need accountability, but it's got to be data that's actionable, right? That's data is only good if you can process it and then do something with it. If it's just a bunch of googly goop on a spreadsheet, it's not actual.
Right. All right. Well,
thank you so much for being here.
Yes. This has been wonderful. Super fun. Hope you'll consider coming back sometime.
I would be happy to. Yes, yeah. Sir. Now that my Gen X self is used to doing a podcast.
Where are you? The butterfly is gone.
That's right.
You were very natural. That's my friend.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you everyone for listening. And we want to remind you that
democracy is not a spectator sport.
We'll see you next time.
We love communication that goes both ways, not just you listening to us pontificate. We would love to hear from our audience. If you have comments, suggestions, or would like to contact us about possibly being a guest on the show, please email notmygeneration@rader.rose.edu.